Welcome aboard to a special summertime edition of College Crosscast. I'm Ryan McDonald.
Hey everybody, I'm Chris Ostremski.
Hey folks, how you doing? It's your boy, Erie Barrister.
And we've got a special guest on tonight from straight out of the MCLA. We've got Jack Coyne joining us in just a second here on College Crosscast. Welcome to College Crosscast. As we said, Mr. Coyne will be joining us in just a second. Glad to have Safe and Chris on board. The band is back together for this one.
It's good to be back in the saddle, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Good to not be engineering this time around.
The last pod. That may have been the greatest pod in pod history.
I was looking forward to your takes.
Yeah,
but
well, we're also looking forward to the women's podcast, so I guess we won't.
Yes, we're still waiting. We're getting closer and closer to finally executing that, and then every freaking time.
I saw
time.
It on Facebook. I saw it.
Yes.
Comment. I think it's coming down.
It's eventually coming. We're getting closer than ever for the women's lacrosse podcast.
Is Christmas.
Yeah. Well, Christmas is right around the corner, too, which means the Dart World.
Chris is doing everything to make us forget the lost pod. Chris, I did enjoy your
damage
one-man
control.
I did
damage
enjoy
control.
Your one-man show, MLL. I thoroughly enjoy it. The studio sound system there is incredible.
It's
just
fantastic.
Sounds so clear. It's great.
As the summer progresses, we'll do more of those special things. We'll have some more little boxes, pods coming in a little bit, too, just that. I've been a bit busy the past couple weeks. My friends have been a bit busy, etc. So we'll have more of those. But tonight, we've got Jack Coyne on. If you've been around Lacrosse Twitter, you've known him. He's been a writer at Lacrosse Magazine and now is part of the MCLA, the premier club lacrosse league in the nation with a lot of big-name schools playing in that below the NCAA level, but varsity nonetheless. A lot of these schools, even though it's at the club level, I guess varsity club. I know I'm kind of contradicting myself, but you got my gist. And we are very happy to have him on board tonight. And here's our conversation with him. Joining us via the telephone is Mr. Jack Coyne. Thank you so much for joining us, Jack.
Gentlemen, it is an honor and a privilege to be on the preeminent lacrosse podcast out there, and I appreciate your time.
Well, Jack, we can't thank you enough. Yeah, we're really looking forward to speaking with you and, you know, just really, really excited about this pod. Obviously, for most of our listeners who know your career, this should be a great, rehash about the stuff you've done. And for any of the youngsters out there who don't know yet, you'll get a great lacrosse education from Mr. Coyne. So really happy.
Yeah. And before we get started, I want to thank you guys for what you guys are doing at College Cross. I love the prospectus every day. I love podcasts. I love everything you're doing, and you're turning into a really important part of the lacrosse community in terms of getting information out there and reporting. So I appreciate what you guys do.
Thank you so much.
Love the kind words, that's for sure. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. It pays off.
All right. Safe, you want to go first?
Yeah, just get started. Again, Jack, thanks so much for joining us. Like I said, just to give some of our listeners who aren't as familiar with your career and stuff like, we always also like to just start with like our guest's background and how they got into lacrosse. So, you know, if you could describe like growing up in Massachusetts and like, you know, how you fell into lacrosse and, you know, I know we'd love to hear about it.
Yep, so grew out in a small little gritty blue-collar town outside Boston called Wellesley, Massachusetts. First time I was introduced to lacrosse was at a prep school I went to called the Noble and Greenough School, and then at Colby College, better known as sort of the safety school for all of the Williams and Amherst applications and low Ivies. Went there, they had lacrosse there, best known, I graduated with a guy named Billy Bush, who went on to some fame and infamy afterwards.
One of my buddies. I was literally going to ask that. I was like, no, Billy.
What's that?
I was like, literally going to ask, did you know Billy when you said Colby? But I thought that was too much of a joke. But yeah, oh my God, that's crazy. That's great coincidence. Yeah,
he was in my graduating class. And I tell you what, Bushy's he's a really nice guy. He's always a good guy. So, you know, it's amazing what people go on to do. And I still love Bushy. I think he's great. But anyway, sort of got my introduction there. Lacrosse sort of made the jump for me. Is after I graduated from Colby, I was an SID for a while, and it started out at the Washington and Lee University down in Virginia, Lexington, Virginia, and lacrosse sort of took on a whole new realm because it's an industry down there. They take it very seriously. They have a huge tradition down there, and I really got to appreciate it down there. And then after 2 years of sort of apprenticing as sort of an assistant down there, I took over at Bowdoin College as sort of the de facto SID there. They have some sort of highfalutin named Director of External Affairs for Athletics. So it made it sound less like the kid eating Doritos in his office while he's punching in stats kind of thing. But did that thing. And Bowdoin had an excellent lacrosse program as well. So that was sort of a big leap as well. And I think actually Bowdoin played WNL one of the years. There was kind of an interesting crossover. So I left Bowdoin in 2001. I sort of had to make a decision about whether I wanted to marry my wife, and she was an Iowa girl. She was in medical school at the University of Iowa. So after her first year, I moved out there in pursuit of master's in journalism, and I was a GA for the football team while I was there running their marketing and stuff like that. And we got married after that. She was in the Air Force. And so I got away from lacrosse a little bit at that point. I was more in football for Iowa. But then when she graduated from medical school, she went in the Air Force. I'll try to get this as brief as I can. We got stationed at Travis Air Force Base out in California. I was working for a small newspaper there called the Dixon Tribune. It was miserable. It was the most miserable experience of my life. And I've worked for putting down dogs at a vet clinic, and this was worse. And and I got a call from my old boss at Washington Lee, who had taken over the communications director job at U.S. Lacrosse, and he said, hey, do you want to help run our website and write for us remotely? And so this is back in 2003, I think. And so I started doing that, and the assumption at the time was, you know, when my wife separated from the military, got into her own practice, that I would go out and get a quote-unquote real job, you know, sort of a go-to-office, do a 9-to-5 thing. But 4 kids later, me driving around and taking care of the kids when she was in the hospital was more cost-efficient than me sort of going out there. And U.S. Lacrosse is very good to me, but I enjoyed the experience. That's how I sort of, the nitty-gritty of how I sort of got my lacrosse career going at U.S. Lacrosse and Lacrosse Magazine.
And then now you're at the MCLA, which is, of course, the premier club lacrosse association, intercollegiate club lacrosse association in the U.S. So making that jump from U.S. lacrosse into the MCLA, how is the adjustment process like?
Yeah, it's a big jump, and there's a lot of things that are very different because it's a jump from sort of journalism, and there was, you know, maybe get into this a little later on, but, you know, U.S. Lacrosse and Lacrosse Magazine, it's a member benefit. You get that as a member benefit. It's not sort of a straight news organization where you're going to get all the facts. I mean, it's PR work for a lot of times, and our mission is to, you know, I hate the term, but grow the game and make the sport look as good as possible. And so there was that component. So it wasn't straight journalism, but it was a lot of writing. I tried to do a lot of feature stories. Now jumping over to the MCLA, it's more of a PR and marketing and trying to put the best face forward for the MCLA because, as you guys probably know, there's a perception about non-varsity or club lacrosse that it's sort of, you know, mismatched helmets, mismatched uniforms, you know, keg on the sidelines, you know, the whole deal, where I'm trying to change that by a lot of different avenues, but these kids are serious about playing lacrosse. I mean, these guys, and you have to think about this, they pay to play lacrosse. They're paying thousands of dollars to the opportunity to play lacrosse in college, where you've got these other varsity teams where it's sort of understood that, you know, they'll get the benefits, uniforms will be paid for, travel will be paid for, all these things. You know, there's a love of the game that I think a lot of people don't understand with MCLA student-athletes and the commitment they make. And so I'm trying to, that's one of the things I'm trying to get out about the MCLA, that, listen, you know, we're never going to get to the level of an NCAA reputation just because of the nature of the beast and being non-varsity, but I want to get it out there that this is a viable option for a kid coming out of high school who maybe he lives in Montana, or he wants to, you know, he's from Massachusetts and he wants to go skiing all the time. He can play at CU or something like that. So it doesn't necessarily have to be the varsity or bust. There are options out there to play good, competitive lacrosse with teams that have sponsors, uniforms, all the gear that maybe the kids are looking for. It's just not at the varsity level. We have a championship that's well run. So I'm trying to change perceptions now, and it's very different from what I was doing at Lacrosse Magazine, which was basically trying to entrench perceptions about lacrosse players and how sort of good and righteous and kind they are.
You mentioned in that little spiel, you hate the term grow the game. What part do you hate about it? Is it just because, you know, with the MCLA, there are plenty of teams in the West Coast, like Stanford and even like Texas and Chapman in California, that not a lot of people outside of the MCLA really know about? That, you know, lacrosse is there in the West Coast, but maybe it's being used because it's not NCAA lacrosse, it's not pro lacrosse?
No, it has nothing to do with that. It's more of it just, I think there's a better, I get the concept and it's an easy one. I just always think that there's a better way to sort of say that we can get lacrosse on the radar. And it gets back to all these things that I hear you guys talking about, the MLL and things like that, and trying to get into communities and, you know, being better at everything. It's just a personal thing. I understand the concept of the grow the game. I appreciate the concept of grow the game. I think we should, and I think the MCLA is probably doing the most out of any collegiate organization to, quote-unquote, grow the game. You know, whether, you know, we can get into places that even, you know, U.S. lacrosse comes to us because we have people in Bozeman and Spokane and Temecula and all these places that maybe aren't established lacrosse areas yet, but it's growing, and we have college kids there that can either teach the game or help just message the game out to people and have games that people can come and watch and say, wow, what's that sport? So the MCLA is in a unique position to help sort of the stakeholders, U.S. lacrosse or whoever it is, to really get a game on the map for a lot of kids that are there. It's just that grow the game hashtag, if you will. It's just I see it, and I think I'd like a different sort of marketing approach than that, I guess. So it's a completely personal thing. It's not anything sort of, you know, the MCLA has its sort of chip on its shoulder a little bit, but we're actually very appreciative because U.S. Lacrosse, you know, Inside Lacrosse, Lacrosse Magazine, Lacrosse All-Stars, all those guys have been very, very receptive to the MCLA, and I think they appreciate it. It's just sort of getting out a little bit further to the sort of that next level of the NCAA that they can appreciate it, and they can only do it if they see it, and that's sort of the challenge for me.
Now, just a quick follow-up. The MCLA championships, you know, they've been a big part of the MCLA, and it's gotten a lot of media coverage in the lacrosse world lately, especially with us and streaming the entire event with Chris Marshall of LAC Sports Network being a color commentator for the entire week. How big has this event been in terms for the MCLA getting exposure to the entire lacrosse community since, you know, IL has some features throughout this season? Trey Lanthier did some stuff with we started to do a little bit of stuff with you guys now. We're good partners now, especially. Thank you for that. So, how big has the championship been in terms of growth for the MPLA?
It's our jewel. I mean, it's one of the things where, for me, and we have our summer meetings coming up, the streaming of our championship and just the coverage of our championship is the culmination of the season, because this is when, because the week that it falls under is sort of this dead area in Division I there's a Wednesday game in Division Three. I think the Division One starts up that weekend. But we have almost a captive audience on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, which is our first quarterfinal and semifinal round, that we can show this off where people are sort of in this lacrosse mode where they just want lacrosse because they've been watching the conference tournaments and the playoffs. And we have, and so getting that out there is really big, where people can see, oh, hey, their helmets match, or, you know, it's, you know, they've got it live streaming, you know, the officials, you know, they got a 3-man crew, and the nets aren't, you know, tied up with whatever, you know, all these perceptions that are out there about club lacrosse, that this is, you know, the talent level, the depth, obviously not there for any level of division or NCAA, but the competition level, the desire, the coaching, all of it is as intense as any other postseason tournament out there. So, yes, it is the most important part of our season. That week is the jewel, and it's my job to get it out there more and more so that people can appreciate it and prospective student-athletes can understand that they don't get to play for any of these programs that maybe they want to, that there are other options out there, and they may end up being one of the best players on these teams or at least a, you know, first-liner to that degree.
Jack, I was wondering, with schools like Utah and University of Michigan making the jump from MCLA to Division One, could you describe to us like some of the difficulties that other schools who may be thinking to make that jump will have to face, and maybe some of the advantages that they would have over a team that doesn't have an MCLA program to try to start off an actual D1 program?
Right, it's interesting because I've talked to John Paul, formerly of Michigan, about this when it was going through, and Utah took a very different approach than John did at Michigan. John built it from the ground up. He built this powerhouse lacrosse program. He worked on the donors, then he worked inside to work with the athletic department to make it viable, and then it was this lengthy, decade-long process where John really worked his butt off and, you know, shook a lot of hands and did a lot of favors for people, and it finally culminated for him. I think it's still one of the best stories about what he was able to do there, because I don't think anybody thought that was going to happen for a while. Utah sort of worked from a different approach. They kind of went top-down where they got this really influential donor. This is from what I understand. I haven't talked to anybody inside the program. This is what I've sort of gotten from feedback. I think you guys have covered it as well. You know, where they've started top down, where they've got the money, they got the donor, and then they brought in this, you know, high level one. He was the volunteer assistant at UNC on the national championship game. You know, three MLL players, and I think got Gilman in now too. Where they built this staff, this huge donor, this money. Where they've got an SID, they've got their own everything. That their social presence in the MCLA is as good as it gets. And then now they finally worked it, so they sort of started at the top and worked their way down. And so they finally did. I wasn't sure if it was going to work. Just some of the rumblings that were out there from what some of the things the AD said. But good on them. They got it to work. And, you know, they're going to have their challenges, but this is fantastic.
And I guess to follow up on that question, do you see even more growth opportunity, even if the MCLA takes a hit with some of the bigger club programs eventually working their way to the NCAA level? You know, the sport of lacrosse is still growing and everything. So what are the growth opportunities on the MCLA level for maybe some of these big name schools, maybe like the SEC, that don't have club lacrosse yet, but are, you know, that could down the line add it on and, you know, become a key integral part in the MCLA?
Yeah, and that's always a challenge because, as you probably guys know about, there's the NCLL, the so-called NICL, which is basically the other club league in the country. It's more East Coast situated. They have very interesting rules. They're not NCAA rules. They don't particularly like to be coached. They like to have it team leaders in that regard. They have a championship. The editor at US Lacrosse right now or Lacrosse Magazine. He's a nickel guy. We used to always joke about that. He played at Delaware. There's room for growth because a lot of nickel teams are looking at what the MCLA does and what kind of wants to get in there. I was at the convention. A guy from James Madison came up to me and was broaching the subject because he says his kids, are sort of dominating the league that they're in, and they're looking at the MCLA, the SCLC, to think, oh, maybe we'll get in there. The big thing is there's a huge jump in commitment for a lot of those teams, and the commitment is both monetary. You're talking probably $1,500, $2,000 a head to have a really viable program. You can do it a little bit less, whereas these guys are paying $200 for the season. You've got to travel. You have to have commitment. You can't forfeit. The expectations are, and there's also an academic requirement. We have you have to get certified by our director of compliance. So there are things that it's not always an easy jump because the MCLA has pretty high standards, far higher than any other club component. And so going to those, you have to have a commitment. And a lot of times you're going to have a 2-year waiting period before you're eligible. So you think about a kid who's a sophomore, or even a junior, why would they make that commitment when they're not going to see the fruits of it? So we're always looking. The door is always open. We're always trying to get teams to come into the MCLA. We just had a huge exodus, as you guys probably know, with the NAIA, when the NAIA went out on their own, because those were all in our league. So we dropped a bunch of them, and they've gone off on their own. They have their own championships now, which is great. And so we take, when it comes to, whether it's Michigan, Utah, the NAIA teams going off on their own, the MCLA, or at least I, try to put out there that we're proud of the fact that we are building programs, and if the NAIA went off, that we're building leagues. But it's not really the mission of the MCLA to necessarily build NCAA programs, because just on the base level, it's not good for business. And secondary, it's we don't feel necessarily that that's always the best option. If it happens, great, we'll follow them, we'll root for them, but it's not really something the MCLA strives to do. We are always looking for teams to join, however.
Talking with Jack Coyne of the MCLA. Now, Jack, we had news came out, I think, a week ago that the only varsity, or at least varsity club lacrosse team in Mississippi, decided to discontinue their program. Now, how are those? What's the struggle with trying to get teams in like these regions that aren't big on lacrosse, especially in the Southeast with Mississippi and Alabama and Tennessee, more football powerhouse states, rather than Maryland and New York, where they're, and Massachusetts, where you're from, which are really big on lacrosse?
Yeah, it really, Millsaps is what you're talking about down in Mississippi. Jackson, Mississippi, I think. These cases are teams trying to, or schools that are maybe in the same conference for a lot of sports, seeing other sports adding lacrosse. I think Millsaps quickly added lacrosse, but when you add lacrosse, you have to have a commitment to the sport. You can't just be filling beds with it, and you can't just sort of roll out the local high school coach to do it, especially in Mississippi, because you're not going to be able to recruit Mississippi to build a viable D3 program if you want to expect it to even, in the SAA, where Birmingham Southern was the king for a while, and I think, there's other teams have popped up since then, Rhodes and Oglethorpe, you have to have the commitment. And it's the same thing, I'm sure, and you guys know better than I, but in Division I, you can't sort of half-ass a program. You can't just add it. You have to make a commitment monetarily, resources. You got to get a coach in there and let him go up to Baltimore and recruit Baltimore and sell it. It's going to not always be the great, a great sell, because people may not want to go to Mississippi, but you have to get that young kid who's going to go out there, give him the money to go travel, recruit, and get kids in. And, down in Birmingham Southern, they got a kid from Roanoke in there. He did it. They made the NCAAs 2 years in a row, if I remember. So it can be done down there, but you have to make a commitment, and I'm not sure Millsaps did.
Jack, just going back to a little bit to your time as a writer, just could you tell, since you had such a great career at Lacrosse Magazine and US Lacrosse. Like, can you just tell us, like, you know, some of the differences you see in some of the major publications like Lacrosse Magazine and IL from when you first started, and maybe, you know, just give us your take on the state of lacrosse journalism in general?
And for our listeners, this is the juicy bit you were looking for.
Well, when I started at Lacrosse Magazine, one of the things, and it was kind of this underlying, it was all good natured, but there was a rivalry between Lacrosse Magazine and Inside Lacrosse, and the rivalry was for scoops, it was for information, it was for better writing, it was for better content, where, you know, I went to Inside Lacrosse every day, and I checked them out, because I was a D2, D3 writer, and I've covered different beats, but I always wanted to know there, and I know the guys like Corey McLaughlin, who's since moved on, and Matt DeSilva, who was the beat writer for Division One at the time. He's now the editor. But I know that there was always this sort of race for content. And, you know, when the Duke thing went on and Hughley, I mean, there was a competition there, and that has fallen off. And listen, Terry Foy, McAneer, Jeff Shannon—they're all great guys. And I think, I don't want to speak for them, it may have been different on their side, but it was just, it made us better, because we knew that we had to be good, because IL was, all you knew IL was going to be on the case, and you were trying to be on the case better, and you wanted to have the better content. I think it's the nature of a rivalry. Over the years, and I left a couple of years ago, that sort of died down, and it's less of a sort of individual thing where I don't want to get scoops, but just the two entities have changed. You know, Inside Lacrosse, a couple of years ago, they went to hosting those huge stadium in-season tournaments. They're not tournaments, but games, because they were trying to make money. Because Dan, or, you know, on the internet, where they're trying to actually sell their item for money, whereas Lacrosse Magazine has, A, this captive audience, where if you sign up to be a US Lacrosse member, you get Lacrosse Magazine. So when it comes to ad sales, we can go to advertisers and say, listen, our run during the season is 400,000 books, you know, a month. And Inside Lacrosse, you know, was, I can't speak for certain, I've heard different numbers, but it was considerably less than that. They're trying to make money. So they altered, from what I understand anyway, you can get Terry on, I'm sure he'd be able to break it down for you better than I, but from what I understood, you know, they had to make up some money that they weren't generating, because magazine sales are a dying proposition as it is anyway. It's a very tough thing to do, and it's very tough, as you may also know, to monetize websites. So they were in a pickle. They went for the huge stadium things, and they did all right with that, and then they've since gone to these combine sort of camp concept now that they're working on to help sort of meet things. And on the other side, US Lacrosse has gone from sort of this news PR group to, and Stenerson has sent out, and they had this big switchover, where they're going more with this internal messaging, you know, using Lacrosse Magazine is not necessarily a hard news or anything like that now. It's just sort of this messaging tool, which honestly, when that came out, I was so glad that I moved to the MCLA, because I probably would have left anyway, because that was a big change for them. So what you used to have is this huge competition, and now it's almost, there's nothing there. You know, you don't have, or at least I don't see sort of that content that we used to have before, and that race for scoops and things like that. So I think it's the nature of the beast. I think you have to make ends meet. In lacrosse journalism, there's not a lot of money in it, and advertising and things like that. And so it's tough. It sad to be a little bit, but it's the way of the world, and you, what happens is you see them adjust, and you also see other people jump into the mix. And I think, and yeah, I was just blowing smoke at the beginning of the podcast. I think you guys are really filling a niche right now that is sort of fallen by the wayside with some other groups. So I think there's really an opportunity here for you guys. But obviously, I understand, you know, and just that prospectus that I read every morning, I know how much time that takes. I mean, I know you guys will whip that up 15 minutes before you go to work. I mean, that takes time. So I think there's opportunity out there, but it's definitely changed. Certainly not for the better, but for the different, I guess.
And I guess, where do we see lacrosse journalism going from here? I mean, at this point, we've got, you know, U.S. Lacrosse and Inside Lacrosse are the legacy ones, and then I guess your next step would be, you know, the blogosphere between us and Lax All-Stars and Lax We Trust, etc. Do you see the lacrosse journalism sphere evolving any bit, or do you think where we stand now with, you know, the websites being the front and center of everyone, essentially? I mean, as much as Inside Lacrosse puts a lot into their magazine, I think, at least, I mean, obviously I'm not on the inside at IL, but I would think that, you know, their efforts are being put towards the website front and foremost, and on Twitter as well. And obviously, you know, we have a big Twitter presence. Lax All-Stars has a big Twitter presence. Are we going to be kind of stuck in this for the next few years, you think, where it's kind of primarily all about the website and Twitter more than anything else? Or do you see it evolving as time goes on?
Well, I understand the gist of your question. I think it honestly, I may be opening a can of worms with the MLL and other things like that, but it really, the sport needs to sort of find, much like the journalism behind it or the coverage behind it, the sport also needs to find sort of a next level. It seems like, you know, we've had these sort of internal Twitter conversations with the lacrosse Twitter people about, you know, attendance sizes and things like that. And I follow you guys and the guys over at IL, because I listened to their podcast for a while about the MLL and all the things going on there. I mean, you have to, the sport needs to make a next step. And I think the journalism will follow, and I think, or the coverage will follow, and I think other larger entities will get into it if they see that there's a market there. But I don't want to get too dramatic here, but there does seem to be a bit of a stagnation with sort of the sport. I'm not going to put on the MLL or the NCAA or anything like that, but it seems like we're waiting, and I don't know if it's for like Rabel 2.0, for this guy who just captured, you know, we're just coming off Lyle Thompson, who sort of, he was the guy who captured everybody's imagination. But, and granted, I don't follow the MLL that much, but I don't hear about him much anymore. Yeah. So, go ahead.
No, I'm just agreeing with your point, because I know I'm an outsider, and, you know, I occasionally try to follow it this year, and, you know, this Lyle Thompson, who's won two Towartons, doesn't really get a peep with his new team in Chesapeake, and he just got traded this past season, so...
Yeah, you made Chris's eyes gleam at his opportunity to go on his MLL tangent again.
Yeah, as I said, I'm not sure if I wanted to open that can of worms, but I don't know, maybe I don't want to be Chicken Little where, you know, the sky's falling here, but this seems to be, we've leveled off, and, you know, the attendance figures and everything, and the sort of the shine of the stadiums for the NCAA Division I championships and the MLL, you know, that conversation is sort of convoluted because, you know, you have a great product, but maybe not the right delivery, whatever that may be. But it seems like there's got to be a next step that happens. And it's got to happen either the Division I or the pro level, because obviously those guys are the drivers of what's going on. You're not going to see anything, you know, creative out of D2, D3, or the MCLA. We're the boats that get risen by their high tide. So, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I do believe in terms of the coverage, I think you'll get a more invigorating coverage, national coverage, with something new with lacrosse, whereas, you know, you have guys like Ed Lee at The Sun, who's the king. I mean, I think he's great, and Christian Swayze and those guys do phenomenal work. Inside Lacrosse, I must say, they are very kind to the MCLA, very good to us. Love IL, and as I said, I consider them a rival. U.S. Lacrosse Magazine, I think, is they've just sort of changed their message. So it gets back to, you know, people wanting to see the coverage there, but, you know, I don't know what your business model is or anything like that, but it oftentimes takes people working for very little, just who are passionate about the sport, and build something and then sort of hope that it catches fire and goes from there. And a lot of times, it's a lot of work for a lot of times, a lot of reward.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the next step. We might get into that in a little bit. Today.
Before Chris goes, I just want to like point out one thing. I guess on the Twitter end, it's kind of funny though. Kind of to your point of taking that next step. I remember when I was in college, the team Twitter accounts, there was maybe like five that live tweeted back in only like 2013. So it's kind of amazing how like, I'm not saying like lacrosse media. I think, you know, lacrosse media has done a good job on Twitter, whether it's IL or Lax Mag or US Lax Mag or anybody else. You know, I think Inside Lacrosse back in the day, even to today as well, you know, Inside Lacrosse back in, you know, the 2010 to 2013 time when I was in college, did a good job of the Twitter presence. But I remember that the teams themselves at the D1 level, like, they weren't even live tweeting games in, you know, the year 2013. And that became, like, such a huge pain in the neck to follow games that weren't on ESPNU, because you got teams that are updating their account at the end of every quarter or every half. So it's, like, it's kind of amazing how, like, the teams have been so slow to adapt, where like we look at live tweeting games now and realize, hey, you know, 4 or 5 years ago they weren't even doing that.
Right, and that's sort of the next step. I guess I should sort of reference it. It's kind of what we do with the MCLA as well. Is a lot of times you're going to have these individual entities, and you take Twitter with a team, where if a team can't get somebody to cover them or video, they can live tweet a game where somebody can follow that, and if they do a good job tweeting, they can give a fairly good synopsis of what's going on so people can keep up to date. We've encouraged all of our teams in the MCLA to live tweet their games, even if, you know, a lot of them use Periscope, the one on Twitter, that they'll use that. Facebook Live, we've had games on. So it's on the MCLA website. What I'm hoping to do more of now that I'm getting used to is getting back to my writing, feature writing as well. So you basically, individual entities take the news out of the hands of sort of these larger news groups and basically take it on themselves and say, listen, nobody's going to follow us. We're going to put it out there because now we have all of these platforms to do it. So that is sort of the challenge, because breaking news is often broke by the teams on all of these mediums that everybody else has, so you really can't break them. That's a great point. I didn't think of that. But yeah, that's sort of what we're trying to do. You know, if we can't get people to bite on a story, if I can't get somebody to cover the story from one of the legacy medias or anybody, I have the ability to just do it myself and put it out there, and that is something very different than, yeah, as you said, just 3 years ago.
I want to steer back a little bit to the state of lacrosse. We have, as Jack, you mentioned, the legacy, quote-unquote, legacy media sources of IL and US Lacrosse Magazine. You have, I would consider, a lifestyle lacrosse blog in Lax Allstars, who also, you know, do an event or two. They have some videos. Us at College Cross, who does a mixture of more news and just covering what's out there. A bunch of other sites. And then podcasts, especially the Bagata Way podcast. Two podcasts, ours, IL's, a bunch of others that I can't really name of. And then you have the video concept. You know, TLN, the Lacrosse Network, has a big presence on Instagram and YouTube with their videos with the two guys out in Los Angeles, which is anywhere near, like, dominant lacrosse country, but somehow they have an audience. And then especially my question to you is involving Lax Sports Network, which is supposed to be a digital-only month all across the network. So, what are your thoughts about LSN, the concept of it, and you think that, you know, it might work out? Was it too early for this kind of concept to go on for lacrosse?
It's a great question. I think in years to come, it's going to be a case study for sort of content on the web. Paywalls have been very, for just things that I've read, even for, you know, huge, you know, massive media conglomerates, paywalls are very prohibitive, obviously, just for the nature of them. But lacrosse people are... I guess the question is, I mean, how many true lacrosse fans are there where just anything will come on and they'll watch it? MLL, NLL, NC Division I, whatever it is, they'll watch it where they're just that much of a sports junkie. And lacrosse is a niche sport, and I think that's what everybody needs to get a hold of, where it doesn't have the popularity. But to answer your question directly, first, grow up, and LSN has been very good at the MCLA. We hope they last and things go well. I was, when they put the paywall up, I thought it was an interesting decision. I wasn't sure how it would work, and I wasn't sure how they'd get all the content, because a lot of the content, you know, ESPN's got a bunch of it, and I'm sure a bunch of it's copywritten. So I was wondering if they have, I didn't anticipate the kind of shows they had, you know, Chris Marshall on there, and the other guys that they have, and the gal, they're very good. I tried to sign up for it, honestly, and this may be another thing. I signed up probably the second month it was on, trying to just check it out, and it was just like, just gave me an error prompt. I must have tried to sign up like five times, just gave me an error prompt. So I don't know. They've contacted us, they covered the MCLA. Honestly, for honest answer, I wasn't sure if it would just get the money it needed for all of the people and the sets and everything that they were doing, because it seemed really ambitious. I assumed, and the guy's name escapes me, Jake
Steinfeld.
Yeah, the guy who runs, I figured this may have been a pet project of his, or it may have been something that he may have thought would work. Since found out it's more internal than that, the MLL. It was ambitious. It was an ambitious idea. Dave Gross, who runs the MLL, is an ambitious guy. He's an idea guy. He thinks of some things outside the box, and some of them, I hope this works out for him well. But long story short, the business model, and I'm not a business guy by any means, but it didn't make sense to me. I hope it works for him. But I guess I'm going to throw this back on you guys, because I think you guys probably watched it and have a better idea. I mean, do you guys feel that it's a workable model or has some life to it?
Well, I'll start since I asked a question. just be curious. I don't know if, say for Ryan, you've watched LSN before. I've actually subscribed to LSN the past two college seasons. Just to mainly watch the college games and try to see the college content. The first year that I was on, it's more of a test run. I honestly, and for both years altogether, I honestly didn't really watch LSN at all, except for the games, and there were only like two or three games that I watched a year that were college games. The content, you know, it doesn't appeal to me. I think, and I said this on my MLL podcast last week, they should, if it's an MLL kind of pet project, just rebrand it as the MLL Network, have more of a focus toward the MLL, because the NLL has their own little, maybe temporary project, airing their games and airing some of their content. So if you're getting some stuff with the NLL, or getting some stuff with the NLL, getting some stuff with, you know, the college game and a little bit of the high school game, I'm not really sure. They do have a high school game of the week, which I kind of did watch as well. That's why I got that as well. But, you know, if it's, I would recommend, I think maybe it is ambitious, and I know they have a free trial right now for 2 weeks, but I'm not sure if I'll watch it again. But, you know, it's kind of a little ambitious, and maybe they narrow their focus. They might have something there that might be similar to what the NLL is doing.
Yeah, I would say, I was on LSN once last year. They have a really good, really good idea going on. They got some really great people working over there too, and I think the idea in general is awesome. You know, all day lacrosse, whether it's live games or studio shows. I think the studio shows are their best asset too. The thing is, I'm just in general a little bit still skeptical on the over the top model in general. Not saying LSN, this being an LSN issue. I just think that, I mean, for God's sakes, awful announcing every 3 days has another thing about live streaming or everything. But for as much talk as we're hearing about, oh, millennials are cutting the cord and going to streaming, I haven't met a single person that has actually gotten off of their cable TV and gone into a streaming service that isn't Netflix or Amazon Prime. I still think that the death of cable TV is a little bit exaggerated. I mean, obviously they're losing subscribers and everything, but I don't see anyone really streaming it. I mean, unless it's Netflix, unless it's Amazon, and I guess unless it's MLB TV, I just haven't really seen that much in terms of going it, you know, full scale into over the top services and everything. I mean, everyone that I know still has cable, and I mean, I guess it's a little bit of bias because in the area here on Long Island, it's, you know, everyone, you got three different cable providers and everything. You have cable, you got Optimum, you got Verizon Fios, you know, you got your DirecTV and Dish Network. But, I mean, that's the thing. And on top of that, the cable companies and phone telco companies still own the internet access. So even, you know, they're still getting theirs if everything goes to streaming. So I think if this over-the-top revolution and streaming revolution comes to fruition, which, again, I'm still skeptical because there's still a million and one different services that I haven't actually heard of anyone I personally know going to it. If it goes to that, I think LSN's going to be well-positioned, especially if it goes into a thing where, you know, they could get themselves onto streaming services and everything. I think the business model for now is fine because we're still in that kind of which way is the television market going to go? Is it going to go online or is it going to stay where it is? I'm kind of thinking that it's going to stay where it is. So I think kind of like with the ESPN soft rollout of the ACC network, it's a good way to see where things are heading. Is it really going on to streaming services? Is it still viable to have a cable network? You know, it gives them some time to buy themselves some time and really see where this industry is going. Because, again, I'm a little bit skeptical that streaming is going to be the future. But by at least having an add-on, you know, $5 to $10 a month streaming thing, you know, like MLB.TV, like a WWE network, like an I mean, NBA League Pass and NHL Center Ice have their own online things. I mean, you could kind of count those as well. But, you know, I guess in terms of people that have actually subscribed to sports things, MLB TV and WWE Network, I think that's a smart play for now and wait it out and see where things head from there.
I mean, just to finish it off, I definitely jumped on LSN the first year just for the college season. Since it was over, I didn't keep the subscription going. Just echoing what Chris and Ryan and you, Jack, have said, like, I agree, the studio people are quite talented. I think Chris Marshall and Josh Hawkins are quite charismatic. They're a good team when they're together. You know, some of the other analysts are great too. I just know Josh and Chris come to mind quickly. I kind of definitely agree with Ryan. Like, the over-the-top model probably works. You know, that's what everyone screams on Twitter. You know, I don't need cable, blah, blah, blah. And then you realize, you know, they got Roku, Apple TV, Netflix, like seven different things. And then when you add it all up with, they still are probably getting Comcast internet. So, like, you know, or whatever, you know, the other big ISP providers out there. So, like, when you add up all the, you know, your different applications and the taxes that go with it, I mean, to me, like, it doesn't make I find just having Comcast and their app on my phone more than enough. You know, I shout out to our parent company, obviously. So I'm always gonna give love to Comcast, but. I don't need Apple TV. I don't need Roku. You know, I have the Xfinity app on my phone. This is a free advertisement, Comcast. You can call us later. I just have the app on my phone, and I can just watch anything I want, anywhere I want already. I don't need seven different things. And, you know, Netflix is kind of cool, but it just seems like another added cost. And LSN unfortunately, at least for me, falls into that category of just like an extra cost that right now I don't particularly need. For free, Patriot League Network does, in my opinion, as good quality. You know, it's not up to ESPN or Big Ten Network, but it's right there. I don't get the Ivy League Network, but you know, when the other games are available on ESPN3, you know, those are you know, high quality broadcast. Ellison did a great job in grabbing the CAA. That's some very competitive lacrosse, and obviously with Towson, being such a good team the last few years, that you know, that's like a quality team for people to be attracted to. But like I said, like, you know, with the NEC Front Row, the America East TV, Patriot League Network, you already have a lot of probably, what's that, like closer over 150 games probably just on those three platforms. And you know, most people already have ESPN. You don't even need, like, most Comcast thing. You can just get the Big Ten Network as part of your basic plan without, like, upgrading to, like, the, you know, the enhanced sports stuff. So I just think LSN is a great idea. It just, kind of echoing what everyone else said, just seems like kind of an added cost. And with so many stuff that's already for free online, it just didn't give me enough to like re-sign up again for the second year.
And I guess just to point out one thing, because you did point out the conference things. I think what LSN's doing fine, but I think that it's kind of the conferences charging money like the Ivy League. Yeah. Now, granted, the Ivy League sublicenses a lot of their games to ESPN3, but like I think that method isn't that great with the $7.95. Like, for instance, back in March, I wanted to watch the Syracuse-Princeton women's game, but I would have had to subscribe for a month or anything. I mean, I get where we're getting kind of out of the, it's becoming outdated for the, oh, pay $2.95 a game type thing. But when ESPN3 is doing it for free, and or you have an over-the-top service like LSN, I don't think it makes too much sense for the conferences themselves to be in the business of charging subscription-based things if they're not on a traditional TV network like Big Ten Network or SEC Network, Pac-12 Network. The ACC network, as I said, is in that wait-and-see mode of whether they want to be an over-the-top or a traditional cable thing. It's looking like a traditional cable thing. It looks like they're going to be starting to move into replacing ESPN News with it or something like that, with the way for their cable negotiations that are up soon on ESPN. But I think the Patriot League putting it on for free is the best advertising they could do for their big games. Now, obviously, the Ivy League's best games are going to be on ESPN or ESPN3 anyway, but I still think it's not that smart for the conferences themselves to be in the business of selling subscription passes to games when it's probably best to, the best advertising is doing it for free.
Yeah, putting it on Twitter and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Twitter especially, like the first lacrosse Twitter game, which was Virginia and Loyola. If you're a non-lacrosse fan, you probably don't know anything about lacrosse because obviously you're a non-lacrosse fan. But, you know, you have that little box pop up in that bottom right-hand corner of the of Twitter, and you see those two numbers next to each other, which is, that's probably going to say, like, hey, this could be an interesting matchup. Like, hey, like, I forget what where both of those teams were. I think they were at least, like, middle 11-15-ish range, so it was kind of would be a really good matchup to watch. Turn that on, and you see Lars Symphony's freaking offense go to work. Loyola combat with that, with Pat Spencer. You know, instant fan right there. Hopefully an instant fan. But for me, honestly, like, by the way, I've never been on LSN, so.
Fingers crossed, Chris. I'm keeping the faith.
Hopefully, yep, trust the process. So,
oh, so you're never getting on now.
Honestly, with, you know, with LSN, for me, I would have to type in a website, try to watch it, or at least log in and watch it where I have a TV here. I'm not, for me, the type of person I am, I'm not going to be the one going to try and watch a live stream of something unless it's my Philly teams, which up in Syracuse, you don't really get a lot, especially the Sixers and the Flyers. And I have that subscription with TSN. You do a great job with out-of-market
Streaming, I would probably definitely watch that because I'm a loyal fan. College, with LSN, you know, during the college season, it's another hassle, and I know watching it for the past 2 years, they have a lot of studio shows. And I'm not really there to have studio shows because we're producing our own content that people listen to. I'm having a lot of other content that IL has and US Lacrosse has and the MTLA has. So why need another medium for just video when you have it at your fingertips with Twitter and everywhere else? So
we haven't heard from Jack in a while.
Yeah, Jack, let's get back to our special guest is Jack Coyne of MTLA. No, that was just a great diversion. Jack, you while you were at Lacrosse Magazine, you focused a lot on the smaller schools, and I know you wrote a lot about Tufts' great run under Coach Daly. As a Massachusetts guy, did you have like a sense of pride, seeing a Mass team get on the stage in such a big way? You know, I know UMass made their run in 2006, but Tufts is one of the at least few Massachusetts teams that come to my mind in recent years with such a long sustained success. I didn't know if you had any stories from that time memorable, or any particular season that was memorable for you. The Jumbos were quite a team, and you know, still are, but they were able to yank away that chokehold that Salisbury had on the D3 title for a little while, and it was great to see.
As I mentioned before, I went to America's Safety School at Colby, and I didn't get into Tufts, so it's a little raw, still a little raw right now, 20 years ago, but no, it's Tufts is great, and Mike Daly, what he was able to do there, less from a Tufts thing, but more from a lacrosse perspective, what Mike Daly was able to do there, and you guys have heard the story that, you know, he is an absolute unicorn in what he was able to do, having not played college lacrosse. And to get a head job in this day and age, when you have all these assistant coaches in Division One who played Division One lacrosse and have pedigreed, you just think about Brian Holman at Utah. You think about what his background is and how qualified he would be. But for a guy to come up with no lacrosse playing experience and get an Ivy League gig in, I think the math is right, they were coming off their Final Four, right?
Mm-hmm. Because
Lars went to Virginia. Lars Tiffany, another proud graduate of the Washington Lee intern system that I was part of as well. And before I forget to mention, a shout-out to my guy, Kevin Anderson, who was the assistant at Notre Dame, was my roommate at Washington Lee. He was a lacrosse intern at the time under Jim Stagnita, who was the head coach there at the time. But anyway, sorry, I'm digressing here. Where were we? Mike Daly, right. So what he's been able to accomplish is phenomenal. I think a lot of things set up nicely for him. Because if you'd asked me beforehand, I think I actually tweeted something out. I didn't think in 100 years he would take that job, just because he has such a great thing going on at Tufts. I think obviously maybe he had more ambitions than I thought he did to get to the Division One level. I never got that sense from him at all. The only thing I can think of, and this is purely my own theory, and I never talked to Mike about this or anything like that. He had to start at the beginning. When Mike Daly was given the job at Tufts, they basically put him in a way to fail. I mean, he was a football coach, and they didn't care about the lacrosse program, and they just gave it to this football coach who had no lacrosse experience. And over the course of however many years, he turned them into a national championship. I mean, it's like a Disney movie, what he was able to do there. And then back in 2012, right before the 2013 season, I think, a couple of their kids got in trouble. Basically came out in an op-ed in the student newspaper that the kids were saying these sexist and misogynistic and racist stuff at a volleyball game, and they did this big thing where an op-ed came out in the newspaper. I mean, how does something like that come out in an op-ed and not by one of the coaches or anybody else there? Anyway, it's this weird thing. Got picked up by the Globe. And anyway, they started the season with about 15, 20 of the top guys getting suspended for two games. And, you know, suspended for two games for racist and misogynistic language? I mean, you get suspended two games for bringing a keg on campus, like stealing a mascot. I mean, if this stuff was... Yeah, this is all my opinion now, and nothing... I've never even talked to Mike about this. But everything didn't fit. And anyway, they basically set him up to fail when they put him in the position. He did everything in his power. I mean, he's adopted kids, like special needs kids, to his program, made their lives amazing, wins national championships, turns that program into the top one, rivals Salisbury. And basically, Tufts let him... I mean, they sold him out. And so... I'm sure you talk to Mike Daly, he's going to say it's because Brown's a great opportunity. But my theory is there's a little bit there where Tufts let him down a little bit because he bleeds that Tufts blue and brown. I mean, I would never thought he left. That's just my theory. That's the only thing I can think of. Maybe I'm just trying to find a reason for him to leave Division III because I thought he was great for Division III. You know, he's the only guy to really be able to stand up to Berkman on the field in terms of tactics and scouting and everything else, because Berkman's at a whole nother level. But I wish Mike the best. I hope he does great at Brown. I know some pieces were in place there for what Kerwin had put in place under Lars. So I hope he does well. But I was sorry to see him go, because I think he was great for Division III. I think he was great for Tufts.
Just a quick follow-up, just since we're on Division III. Like, that was, I mean... Daly's jump was rare in and of itself, just not having that much of a lacrosse background. And then also coming from Division III to Division I, it was just, a little bit unusual. You mostly see assistant coaches or other Division I coaches get D1 jobs. Have you thought that, you see potential for any other coaches that were in D3? Or, I mean, I just think of somebody who... Coach Daly faced a lot was Coach Berkman of Salisbury. Just with your history in lacrosse media, was there ever whispers about him maybe making a jump, or have you heard of, like, you know, is there any other instances that were close to the Daly situation of a D3 guy jumping up to D1?
Just a couple of years ago, and you guys know the timeline better than I, from what I've been told by a very good source, was that Jim Berkman was a finalist for the Navy job. When Jim Soule got, I think it's Jim Soule, or Coach Soule, got it just a couple of years. Probably the last chance. I mean, just because of Berkman's age, and honestly, he's got a great thing going there. Whenever Berkman hangs him up and Coach Axel, his assistant, takes over for him, that'll be a sad day for Division III as well. But I have to believe, and I haven't heard anything, I've never actually talked to Jim about it, whether he did have other opportunities. You know, I've talked with Ray Rostan down in Hampton City, and not just the opportunities that he had at different places, but, you know, my thinking is if, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if I'm the AD at Binghamton or something like that, because Berkman's a St. Lawrence guy, grew up in upstate, I would bring him in just for what he can do, but you never know when these situations happen. We don't know what's going to happen with Daly. You know, you look at different places where you've got guys that have been there forever. The program's cruising right along. Middlebury comes to mind on this. And you bring in somebody new, even though they may be a protege or something, things just change. I mean, coaches mean that much. So I think Jim Berkman, should have gotten a chance. I hope he did and turned it down just because he loves Salisbury so much. I don't know for a fact, but if I was an AD at a sort of lower level D1, I think I would have taken a chance. And maybe people have, and Berkman didn't want to do it, but I definitely would. And I think there's a ton of good Division III coaches out there that would do well at the Division I level. But you have to understand, you reach a point in your life where you have a family and things like that. I mean, you have job security at Division III, where you go to Division I, especially at a higher level, you've got a window. And that's why I think it can be not all that it's cracked up to be, where you can get a nice, you know, some of the schools, the private schools, to pay pretty nicely in Division III, create a mark, get a little job security. It can be a pretty nice life. So it probably depends on your ambition and your age and things like that. I hope to see more D2, D3 guys because I think they can. I'm not sure if an AD is willing to make that risk with his donors and everything like that to go to small school.
Then you just mentioned the D2. You know, we have college. We have D1, which is the king. D3 gets a good amount of coverage. And then all of a sudden you get the D2 and it's just a little valley, and then you just get over the hill of D3, and it's like, where's this D2 lacrosse coverage? You have Lemoyne, you have Limestone led by the legendary J.B. Clark, you have Merrimack, you have some of these other good D2 teams as well, Lower Rhine and Adelphi. You know, what do you think the reason is behind not a lot of the D2 coverage? Is it because there's not a lot of good teams, or not a lot of teams in general in Division II?
I'm guessing it's a staffing issue from the coverage standpoint. I loved covering Division II. It was fantastic. Those guys were very receptive, very responsive. All those programs you talk about, Dan Sheehan, J.B. Clark, Mike Morgan, Merrimack, talking to those guys, they called me back in 5 minutes if they didn't do it. They craved the coverage. They've got good talent. They have good championships. And it's an up-and-coming league. They've been adding teams at a rate far higher than Division I and almost approaching Division III. But this, I don't want to, I guess, apathy, maybe the term, that the fan bases in Division II aren't quite as strong. It seemed like, just from the feedback that I've gotten from stuff that I've written and things like that, So maybe in terms of eyeballs, maybe the coverage isn't worth it. But just in terms of the kids that are playing in Division II, the coaches and their commitment, and just even the games themselves and the excitement, it's a great league. And it's sort of one of these mysteries because Division II, it seems like in every single sport, is sort of this lost land. And I honestly don't get it. Maybe somebody has a better idea than I do. But I love covering Division II. And I was as sad as leaving Division III as I was Division II. It was a fun league.
I think the issue with Division II, I mean, it's been growing, but compared to the D3 level where you have a ton of schools, I think the issue with D2 is the lack of schools and that they're kind of bunched all together. Like, here on Long Island, we have nothing but D2 schools. I mean, we have Post, we have NY Tech, we have Molloy, we have Adelphi, and we used to have Dowling, all in D2. So I think kind of the issue is Newsday does a very good job of covering the D2 schools here, but the issue is that there's too many schools too bunched together, I think, is kind of the issue with D2. Now, that's changed a little bit with schools like the University of Tampa, but I just think that's kind of the issue, is that it's too few schools too clumped together. Battling for that same...
There's nothing in Baltimore either. I mean, there's basically nothing. So they have a bigger junior college president in Baltimore than they do D2. I mean, you go from, this University of D.C., that's basically the only, but you go from pretty much North New Jersey down to, like, Charlotte, and there's nothing. And so that's a big lacrosse base you're leaving out. But it's growing, and I don't get it, because you've got all the New England teams, the New York teams, the Long Island teams, then you've got the Florida teams, and you get sort of this pocket in the Carolinas. There's stuff growing, but you're probably right. Just geographically, it's tough to get any sort of continuity when you're that sort of bunched up in these different regions.
Go ahead, Chris.
No, you go.
No, I just was wondering, like, where do you see, what do you think are, like, some of the things holding lacrosse back from, we were discussing a little bit about, like, getting on to that next level. Is it just time? Like, I think it's one of our common themes that we have here is, like, we feel like lacrosse is just going to follow the same template as football especially, but also college basketball. You know, both were kind of Northeastern prep school sports that then, you know, slowly moved their way across the country. It just seemed, for us, we kind of just feel like, you know, it's mostly going to be time is the one issue before. I mean, I don't think it's going to be bigger than college football in Alabama anytime soon, but, like, I just feel like some of the problems that football has is going to, you know, cause less kids to play it. And sports like basketball and soccer are great. I love them both. But, you know, if you're looking for that type of collision sport, that football kind of gives you, you know, hockey's your only other option besides lacrosse. I don't know if you thought, you know, you've just been in the media for a good amount of time and, you know, just have such a wealth of knowledge. Like if there was a commissioner for college lacrosse, if Trump did something tomorrow, like, you know, what are the areas that you could see could help, you know, not just growing the game like how we have been, but like maybe sustaining it and making it bigger, you know, in the areas that it already isn't?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, it's one of these generational questions because, you know, when I was growing up, which is, I'm far older than you guys, but, you know, soccer wasn't really that big a deal. And they've sort of had this boom now where it's basically an entry, it's like a gateway sport to youth athletics. You know, everybody just starts with soccer. I mean, a lot of it's just the simplicity of the sport. I think the problem that lacrosse runs up against, in terms of getting to that next level, is, and everything's relative, I suppose, but it's kind of like hockey, where it's a somewhat expensive sport. There's a lot of gear involved, and there's also a demographic issue where, you know, you have to sort of get over a bunch of demographics, whether it be socioeconomic or race or whatever it may be, to really get into that. And that, a lot of that, as you say, it's going to be time where you have another generation that plays lacrosse where the expectation is, okay, you know, I need to see this at the pro level. I am going to the championship game, and the numbers go up. And you know, we've talked about the MLL, and I've listened to your podcast about, you know, what they need to do to sort of you know, put themselves at the next level. There's so many factors involved with it that it's tough to sort of come up with that one sort of magic bullet that's going to say, okay, this is going to make lacrosse where the light bulb will go off at somebody at ESPN where, and I see you guys joking about it, where, you know, instead of drone racing, you know, maybe they'll play a replay or whatever like that. And at the same time, you asked the question, I think, Chris, may have been you, like, why is drone racing have already this huge audience, this niche audience where it makes it worthwhile for them or worthwhile for advertisers to put that on? And I don't know. And listen, I'm not a rules tweaker. I'm probably the antithesis of a rules tweaker. I'm more of a conservative in that regard. But I don't know. You know, I hate the two-point shot. I hate the shot clock. But at some point, you got to ask, well, all right, you know, if we reach this level of static growth, you know, you have to start looking at things. And not that the sport will die; it'll always be there. It's grown to the aspect. It's going against baseball, which is in a death spiral. And I say that as the father of three children and soon to be four children will be playing baseball or are playing baseball. It's complicated. I'll put it that way. And like the other question, I'll throw it back to you because I'm curious. I mean, do you guys have a magic bullet? Is there one thing?
I mean, I'll go first as I give these guys a couple seconds to think of one. I think price is the big thing. Aside from time, like I wholeheartedly agree with you. Like soccer kind of blew up, you know, it had the added benefit of having, you know, it's the biggest game globally. And, you know, we had the World Cup in the United States that kind of kicked off the interest. And you're exactly right. It's just the easiest sport for children to play because they're just kicking something, you know. So that's kind of how they get in early. But exactly. It's lacrosse is definitely cost prohibitive. It's not as bad as hockey. But I think, you know, if we could somehow get some type of some super aluminum alloy or whatever, you know, I'm not a chem guy, but, you know, something to make these sticks much cheaper, you know, that could be a big big step, because you know, once you have that, and then I think once I also think it's going to happen with, especially starting to happen in the Northeast, as kids, less parents let their kids play football, you know, schools are going to try to allocate some of the funds that they have for football to other sports, and lacrosse, you know, you still have to have pretty much the same amount of padding as football. So, you know, maybe certain schools will, like, if they stop playing football as much, like, that could also help make lacrosse less cost prohibitive, because, you know, the school would provide some of the gear for the kids. But I think, you know, I think a lot of it is, it's, you're exactly right, it's cost, you know, it's pretty hard for, you know, single mom that's, you know, in California, who kids are interested, you know, it's kind of expensive to first get their first stick, helmet, pads, then you know, lacrosse, for one thing, you can say it can get a dollar out of its participants, because, you know, you got camps, you got all these club teams, you got, like, just these tournaments, you know, just so much money, you know, just sucked out of your wallet, and, you know, you kind of see that, you see whenever people talk about the high expenses of youth sports, lacrosse is usually number two right behind hockey. And, you know, if you take out the amount of money it costs to, like, rent the rinks, lacrosse may be higher, you know. But I'm with you. I think, like, you know, a lot of it has to do with cost. If you can somehow make some of this equipment cheaper, you can get some kids earlier on, and then maybe, you know, there'll be, like, a crossing of the streams where finally, you know, certain schools maybe de-emphasize football and, you know, use lacrosse as a substitute.
Yeah, cost is the big one. I think another one, not to beat around the bush, is race. I mean, it's still a sport that's stereotypically upper-class white people in the Northeast. I think if we solve some of these socioeconomic barriers that we discussed, that SAFE was discussing with cost, and the other thing is, you know, make it A, more welcoming, and B, more accessible for minorities, and, you know, promoting the game with African American and Latino populations, Asian populations, Middle Eastern populations, that's going to go a long way. And I think we're starting to see some of that breakthrough with players like Miles Jones and Trevor Baptiste in the African American community. Obviously with the Native American community, with the Thompsons, but obviously lacrosse is ingrained in the Native American culture, so that's kind of moot point to spread. But I think if we, and you know, going back to Kyle Harrison back in Hopkins when he was there, I think if we promoted those players more, and, you know, again, try to take away that upper class white stigma that's still in the sport, and kind of promote the game as, hey, lacrosse is for everyone. It's not just for your rich white guys in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic. I think that's going to go a big way in growing the sport. And again, it's going to be longer than we think, maybe, that of football dying out, especially when football's that one big ticket out of a poor community or in a segregated district. This is kind of the only way you can stand out if you're black, is to be good in a sport like football or basketball. So this whole football's dying deal is going to take a little bit slower in those circumstances. But I think if lacrosse welcomes itself more to minority populations, you're really going to see a big uptick in the talent level and a big uptick in participation as well.
Yeah, both of you guys, Brian and I agree. Right. Well, first, the cost. I remember chatting to someone on Twitter that now has blocked me. The cost of soccer and the cost of baseball. It's really easy to play soccer just on the street. You look at, you know, videos from, like, third world countries, like, you know, Mexico and parts of Mexico, Venezuela, Brazil especially, the South American countries. All they need is a ball and their feet, and really they can just draw up their goals and find, like, a hard play, like, some place to play. They can just have makeshift goals, and they'll be playing soccer, and that's it. Beach soccer, heck, it's so easy, and not that cost. It doesn't cost a lot to play soccer. And then with baseball, same thing. Third world countries, all you need is some kind of stick. I remember watching, like, some kind of some MasterCard commercial, like 10 years ago. And these like little kids in like third world countries with like these little sticks and just make base where they just play baseball. Simple as that. And lacrosse doesn't really have that for the most part. It's, you know, T.C. Powell's trying to promote speed lacrosse, but with that, it's still kind of a little costly. But it's not as costly as, you know, typical regular lacrosse or with hockey. And then we get the race. You know, African Americans starting to get in lacrosse with Miles Jones, Harrison, and Baptiste. But it still has its own struggles. I know with a lot of African Americans are stars in football and they're stars in basketball. I would guarantee you if I go to Philadelphia and North Philly or somewhere in West Philadelphia and I try to get lacrosse popular, they would probably just go to another sport, basketball, because it's a basketball-heavy city. But some of these Philadelphia public schools, I know Northeast and George Washington, they're starting to get lacrosse a little bit. Gideon Brockenbrough, a former Roman Catholic, he's now in the States, another African-American from the inner city of Philadelphia going into the game. But mine, I would say, amateurism. I mean, to be quite honest, the pro game, they're only making $10,000 to $25,000, I believe, like, it's a season, if I'm correct. Not a game, a season. And, you know, it's all these guys, for the most part, all these guys have jobs somewhere else, 9-to-5 jobs. And we learn about, you know, the red eye flights back after games to get to work on time. We hear about, you know, guys, lawyers, studying to be a lawyer, like Kevin Rice's. They work in offices from 9-to-5, and then they take late flights to get to their practice, late night shoot around at like 9 o'clock at night, a day before their games. So they leave themselves to try to promote these games when most of their players are working 9-to-5 jobs or somewhere else that might not be in lacrosse itself. So maybe if lacrosse, and I believe the MLS isn't really a semi-professional league because they have these guys that are playing not only for, you know, their countries, if they are able to play for their countries, but also for their MLS team and, you know, the EPL or whatever. So that's a full-time job in itself. Cause I remember seeing Revolution players the Friday before championship weekend. They were out at Gillette Stadium working out. Not the game Saturday or Sunday, but they were still working out. So in pro leagues, it might jumpstart a little bit. Hey, I'm talented in lacrosse. Maybe not as big as race or lacrosse, but I think it's still up there. By the way, with race, you talk about African Americans. What about, you know, other races? Indians from India, like Asian Americans. You know, growing to that kind of. You know, with those, we don't really hear about how the game is growing to those kind of ethnicities, Latinos elsewhere, growing the game, especially in those kind of, like, ethnicities that we don't really hear about, Europeans as well, growing the game and to make it a worldwide game might be big for to take the next step for lacrosse.
Jack, any other thoughts on that?
No, I think It's multi-tiered, multi-leveled, multi-faceted. And plus, we have to sort of see how it plays out. You know, that was your original thesis, that it was sort of maybe time that we needed. But I think, you know, after hearing all this stuff, clearly it's time, but it's also needed. You know, and we hear about all these things, you know, guys like Harlem Lacrosse and those guys getting into areas and bringing the sport that would otherwise not be introduced to it, which I think is great. And I know U.S. Lacrosse has initiatives in that regard, and they give out grants to areas that maybe don't have the money to start up in lacrosse, Wisconsin. Here, I was talking to somebody who I just spoke to, actually at a baseball game, who runs the local lacrosse youth league here, which I didn't know existed. And I was talking to him about possibly approaching U.S. Lacrosse because there were some underprivileged kids that wanted to play and didn't have the access because of the cost of the sport. So it's all these things, but as you know, these things don't happen overnight. It takes philanthropy, it takes dedication, like those guys that are up in Harlem. It takes a bunch of stuff. So, hey, it's just not an easy answer. You'd like to say it's right around the corner, and we're right here. We're gonna have a 15, 16 team league, pro league, and all this other stuff. The MLL and the NLL are gonna join forces and give us this incredible product year all year long, featuring the best players in North America. But a lot of ifs, ands, or buts. So, fingers crossed, I guess.
I agree with, I remember your earlier point about growing the game. Like, I think that's the biggest thing, like, problem for me. It just seems like just this nonstop push to grow just to grow. Like, it feels like you was that phrase, like, it's a lake that's a mile wide, but, like, you know, only an inch deep. Like, I just think about, like, the noted hotbeds. Like, I would still say lacrosse is probably like fifth or sixth, maybe not in like right in Baltimore, but like in, Jersey, Philly. I don't know if this is that true in Long Island, Ryan, but lacrosse is still like fourth or fifth, like major sport for, I just think there's plenty of growth in
Long
the
Island.
Area. Like I said,
Long Island, I would say it's in the top three.
Top three. Okay. Then like Long Island, Baltimore, outside of those, like, everywhere else is probably like, fourth or fifth biggest sport. So I agree. I think like there's still room to grow in the areas that lacrosse is already in. But I know if we've taken too much of your time already, Jack. I don't know if you, talk a little bit about the Pro League. I know we got into it just a little bit at the beginning. Do you not follow the MLL or the NLL as much? Obviously as MCLA, but I don't know if you had any thoughts about them. Like, we've been pretty excited about the NLL because of Marissa's report a couple weeks ago that there might be a team coming to Philly. So obviously that got Chris and my attention. But I don't know if you had any thoughts on the state of pro lacrosse you wanted to share, or we can definitely go straight to football to close up.
I do have a personal question before we get to other sports, but we can start off with the pro game.
Okay, on the pro game, honestly. It's been going on for a while. My first NLL game, we were stationed at Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho, and it's about 50 minutes from Boise, and I drove up to Boise to cover a scrimmage between the Rush. They were the Edmonton Rush at the time. I don't know if that's still the case. And I think they were playing the Washington team. I think it was the Stealth. It was the one Doug Locker was working with. So I went up and covered them. I talked to them after the locker room. And honestly, it was the first NLL game I'd gone to, and it's been the last NLL game I've gone to. But it was interesting. I suppose if there's one in town, you could get going on it. So the NLL, I see it. The MLL, maybe it's just that I've been ruined by the college field game. But the MLL is, it's tough for me to watch. I know they're the best players and they're going all out, but I don't know whether I just need the boxes, set up a certain way where I just need to have visually, I need to have it set up, and I used to be a former official, so maybe it's just the dynamics of the field, but it's very tough to watch. It's tough for me to get into. So I don't know if it's just a rules thing or what, because obviously the players are fantastic. I want to like both of those leagues. I would love to get into them. I don't have anything near me. I guess that's not true. I guess Minneapolis has a team, the Hornets, the Swarm.
Right? Oh, no, they're in Georgia now.
No. All right. So I guess I don't have anything near me anymore. So I guess maybe I would like to get into a team. It's just nothing really nearby. Nothing I could bring my kids. I'd love to get my kids in lacrosse, and that'd probably be an easy entry into that. But, I guess, I don't know. I don't like to think of myself as an apathetic lacrosse fan, but I just really never have gotten into it.
I'm moving on to a little bit of a personal stuff before we get into the football takes.
We got one more question. I mentioned earlier the next step, and with the news today, that the reported news that the LA Times is saying that Los Angeles is getting the 2028 Summer Olympics, and there's now this big hoopla that, you know, with after the women, the World Games aired the Women's Lacrosse Championship, you know, it's time for lacrosse to get the Olympics. What are your thoughts about that? Is it a little too much, too early for the games to be, the lacrosse to be in the Olympics, especially with, you know, how the FIL works, where, you know, for example, I know this Paul Kirkatera, Syracuse great, lives in Connecticut, went to, was a Long Island guy, he played for Team England. You know, they don't really have a lot of Englishmen playing on Team England. Is it a little too early for lacrosse to be in the Olympics?
I think we have a little bit of a blinders on from an international perspective, because when you look at the roster of sports that they have in the Olympics, you know, any American's like, what? You know, they have that in there and not, you know, lacrosse or baseball or whatever. That's my thinking. I honestly, one thing, I don't cover the, or I don't follow the pro game as much, I do follow the World Championships. And I don't know whether it's just I'm a proud American where I'm a junkie and I want them to, like, I was really bummed out when the Canadians beat the U.S. In Denver. Like, that bothered me. And I followed it, I watched it. I don't know if you'd have that access. I'm sure now that they stream everything. But just that whole, spectacle with the World Championships for lacrosse, it's been sort of this own entity. So I love that. If it made the Olympics, I think it would be great. I don't think so. I don't think it will be for a long time, to be honest with you. This seems to be sort of this existential question for lacrosse people, quote-unquote, where if they don't get into the Olympics, it somehow diminishes the sport. I don't necessarily agree with that, just because of the other sports that are there that are so outrageously esoteric that it doesn't really bother me. I watch the Olympics for three sports, typically three or four sports, whether winter or summer, and so I kind of like the World Championships having its own stage in lacrosse. But if people are looking for some sort of, what would be the word I'm looking for, accreditation or satisfaction or something like that of being in the Olympics, I mean, the Olympics, I don't know, maybe I don't see the Olympics as other people do, but I don't think lacrosse will be in the Olympics by 2028 for LA, put it that way.
I think it might get into LA as a demonstration sport. I don't see it as like a medal sport, but I can see it as a demonstration sport.
I agree.
Yep.
Okay, so moving on to a personal question before we get to the football stuff, which I'm not going to add it in too much, I guess. But making the move from Massachusetts to Wisconsin, how's life in Wisconsin and, you know, having a family and raising them there, it being a little bit out of the lacrosse hotbed region but staying connected to the sport?
Yeah, I mean, obviously technology has made it considerably easier, because that was one of the running jokes I had when I would call up. I was on the phones a lot when I was with Lacrosse Magazine, just calling people, interviewing and stuff like that. And they'd see the 608 number area code pop up, or it would say lacrosse on their caller ID. And, you know, when people, it took a while for people to figure out that I was living in Wisconsin, but I had been living in Idaho and in California prior to that, so that was kind of just as odd. It took a little while. People sort of got used to it. But as far as Wisconsin, love this place. Great place to raise kids where I'm at. Couldn't be happier. Wisconsin, another fun fact, is one of the, I think, four or five states in the country that doesn't have an MCLA team. We used to have Wisconsin, but they've gone belly up. So, yeah, it's kind of weird in that respect. But it's been a wild ride, you know, just bouncing around and doing this whole thing. And you got another kid on the way, so number five will complicate matters. But no, it's been a good ride. Lacrosse has been very good to me. I've met fantastic people during my time covering all the different sports, all the different places. You know, I talk about that NLL game up in Boise when I was up there. I went in the locker room and was talking to those guys. You know, some of them are Canadian, obviously. Couldn't have met a nicer bunch of guys. And I find that at every level that I've been at covering, you know, because I used to cover, I'd go to the championship weekend and do a sidebar or something like that in Division I. And everybody's been so nice and been very good to me. And so you guys coming into the mix, you guys are great guys. It's just been a very fun ride for me in lacrosse. I hope it lasts, but you never know. But no, it's been good. And so I hope you guys can gain as much satisfaction through the sport as I have.
I mean, it has been an incredible ride. You know, these 2 years in charge, but it's been fun. I guess we got to talk a little bit of football. I got to assume Pats fan, right, as a Massachusetts guy? Or have you adopted the Packers as your team since you're in Wisconsin?
I have a flag that I put out in my front yard, and all my neighbors are Packers fans. It's got the Patriots flag on
That's
there.
Great.
And it's funny because 2 years ago when we played the Seahawks, I had probably 40, 45 people over, you know, friends and their kids that are my kids' age, and we watched it. And everybody was rooting for the Patriots because they had just lost to the Seahawks, and they hated the Seahawks. This last year, they just lost to the Falcons, but the shine was off. Everybody was rooting against the Patriots. And same type of party, and everybody left, I think out of sort of respect to me. Everybody left at the end of the third quarter. There was only like four or five people that stayed for the whole game. They thought I was going to be like, you know, suicidal or something like that, where they mostly all left. I think it was, 28-3 at that time. And so everybody kind of bolted. There was probably five or six people and maybe two or three kids that stuck around. And, you know, we watched what happened. So now they're already... I've already been saying I hope Green Bay's in the champion or in the Super Bowl this year, just so I don't have to host the Super Bowl again. I love the Pats. My son has adopted it, sort of, and he's got his friends to hop on it. But my oldest son is a front runner of the nth degree. So once Brady retires, whenever and the Pats go off the cliff, he'll be hopping on the Packers bandwagon before.
Did you have any doubt last Super Bowl, even when you were down 28-3?
Oh yeah, no, I was. You know, I didn't want to be that guy that was at the party and like cursing and yelling at the screen, whatever, trying to make everybody the drinks, make sure everybody had food. You know, didn't want to go out like a psychopath. And so when everybody left, I kind of sat down and sort of grabbed a Jameson and sort of watch the carnage, and all of a sudden things started happening. And but no, to answer your question, no, I had no concept that they would come back. I thought that was done.
I'd like to just point out that back in the year 2015, I would like to thank the New England Patriots for hosting Sam Bradford's greatest win as a football player, as the Eagles defeated the Patriots. So,
shout out Chip Kelly.
Yes. Well, Jenkins and Darren Sproles and Sam Bradford.
It was a magical day. Was that in Foxborough or Philly? I can't remember.
That was a crazy game. I thought there was no chance we were going to win that game.
Well, you've got LeGarrette Blunt now, so things are coming up Philly these days.
Slimmer.
Oh, I think you have Chris Ryan or Chris Long too, right?
Yes, Long Blunt. Yes.
Chris is going to be at training camp this year.
Mm-hmm. I'll be
right
training camp. Well, since we're recording Monday, I'll be there Tuesday, Wednesday, and a little bit of next week, and maybe 2 weeks from now. So it'll be fun. I'll get to see Jeffrey and LeGarrette. So I'll tell him that you said hi. And Chris.
Please do, yes. Carson, obviously, not an Iowa guy, but sort of, North Dakota's kind of upper Midwest. So we'll give him the nod there.
Midwest Bob,
being a former Bison. Exactly. Guys, I truly appreciate you guys having me on. It's been a blast. If you need anything, information, whether it be the Patriots or other sundry items, please don't hesitate to contact me. I'll keep you guys in the loop with everything MCLA. And I say this again without any kind of sarcasm. I'm reading you guys. I know a lot of other people are too. So keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Jack, very high praise. Very high praise from you, Jack. Thanks so much for hopping on board.
Really appreciate the kind words.
Have a great night.
Yeah, take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Okay, that was Jack Coyne. So thankful for him to join us. You can follow him on Twitter at Jack_coin. That's Jack, J-A-C, _coin on that. Before we wrap up, any lacrosse tidbits to share, Chris, on the transfer wire or anything like that?
Well, we just posted a little update, I think, a week or two ago. But other than that, I have not heard anything new. I know Mark Pion, shout out to Tom Peace for getting that scoop from Harvard to Johns Hopkins. So that's another defenseman the Blue Jays get. By the way, they do return Patrick Foley next year. That's another big gain. We're still waiting on Drew Sapinski, to be quite honest. That's only the only big name transfer that's still out there that hasn't had a confirmed landing spot yet. Haven't heard a lot about him, about where he's going, and heck, God, he could honestly stay at Hopkins, because just being granted his release doesn't mean he's going to go anywhere. Notre Dame granted Ryder Garnsey his release, and he decided to stay at Notre Dame, so, you know, all options are possible for Drew.
Alrighty, safe.
I hope Drew doesn't leave, and all transfers welcome. You'll find me with a big sign in front of Homewood, especially if you're a goalie.
Alrighty.
I know Adam heard some nice whispers about goalies, but this unconfirmed, so we can't share those.
Womp womp. Alrighty, so as usual, you can follow us online at college_cross. I'm at RyanMcD29.
I'm at CF Jastrzemski.
I am at Erie_Barrister. You can follow Jack's Twitter, and honestly, he's probably one of the best Twitter accounts in all of across Twitter. It's at Jack, that's JAC_coin, COYNE. So Jack_coin.
All right, otherwise, as usual, subscribe to us, iTunes, Google Play. We have periodic podcasts. As I said earlier in the show, I'm going to try and get some more Little Boxes Project podcasts coming up soon. It's been a busy stretch for my friends and I, so we'll have some of those coming up in a bit, as well as some other special ones, Chris's monologues, and anyone else in the bunch wants to do a podcast of their own, they are more than welcome to, and I'll put them up. Otherwise, yeah, we'll still in our off-season pattern, periodic podcasts and the like, so next time you hear us is the next time you hear us. But hope everyone's summers are going well. Hope you enjoyed this one. This was a real blast, and thanks once again to Jack Coin for joining us. He was a fun talk.
Absolutely. Shout out Colby College!
All right, and from all of us here at College Cross, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Take care.
Bye, Felicia.
And obviously, it's the summer, so stay hydrated. It's hot out.